cliffcentral.com.
Yes, your buddy with Mikasa. Obviously, you like Mikasa, huh? I always thought that song was actually about you.
No, but no. I do like Mikasa. Great guys. Very nice as well, because, you know, with some people, when the superstar gets to their heads, they all of a sudden turn into douches. These guys are very chilled, very nice. So, love Mikasa.
Sounds like you got some personal experiences there.
No, well, I mean, they've been to the studio a couple of times, yeah, and every time that they're around, you know, they're really great.
Incredible chef as well, huh? Okay, we've got our shadow in the studio. Please step forward, microphone 4C. You're part of the show, dude. I mean, come on. You've been here. You were here before Sia today, so you're definitely part of the show. Right, so just touching on this one more time with Sia. Roscoe says, Sia, like everyone else, when late, your pay should get docked. And then Riet has some very good information here on this. Listening to CliffCentral.com on the CliffCentral app. Siaki, early is on time. On time is late. Late is fired.
Oh.
That's okay. Fair, huh? Wise words.
Trial by Twitter. Got it.
No, it's an adoring fan base, yeah. All because they like you and they just want you to be here. Nothing else than that. Right. It is now time for... So, Mubs, what's happening in the news?
Well, you know, in a country like the United States, whenever there are suspicions of a bomb threat, you usually, you know, rise to order and you make sure that you are in there and dismantle the situation and deal with it before anything drastic happens. And so an employee of the Spielothek Casino, sorry, this isn't in the US, this is in Germany, the Spielothek Casino in Germany, heard a ticking and humming noise from a men's bathroom trash bin earlier this week, right? Ooh, no. And so he thought to himself, oh, no, this is not good news. After all, we are in Europe. You never know what ISIS are planning. It could be anywhere. It could even be in a bathroom rubbish bin. And so this guy called the police after he heard the ticking and humming noises. Cops came in. They evacuated dozens of people from the casino and adjacent shops. They blocked off the street and called in the bomb squad. The bomb squad eventually found something not so explosive in the trash. It was a penis ring that was vibrating.
Ah, a penis ring. Gareth, have you left your penis ring in the toilet?
Oh, I forgot that. I'm so sorry that I caused an international incident.
Yes, you did, Gareth. How dare you?
Yeah. What kind of people? First of all, what are you doing with that in a public bathroom?
It is dodgy. I don't know if people are still having sex in public bathrooms, but it's very suspicious.
If George Michael wants to do it, let George Michael do it.
Yes, but George Michael should understand that, you know, in a current Europe where everything is a little bit fractious and tenuous, and, you know, there are a lot of terrorists running around, you can't be leaving your cock ring lying around.
Yeah, true.
The superintendent for the police authorities there was quoted as saying, "This is something I have never seen in the 36 years that I've been on the force." And as for where the battery-powered sex toy that caused all the panic came from, nobody knows. Nobody knows.
Can you imagine, wow. 30 years in the German force, you must have seen some things, huh?
can I ask you guys something? Have you noticed, and this is totally unrelated to what you're talking about now, but have you noticed WhatsApp have suddenly got this end-to-end, like, encryption thing going on?
Yeah.
Yeah,
have you spoken about this already?
No,
we haven't, Gareth. Michael was going to follow up on this, is what it actually means. I know Kat yesterday was fascinated by it. I don't know. Is WhatsApp just trying to cover its bases? Is it because of the whole? Is it because of the whole iPhone thing, and the FBI?
Well, it's quite clever. I mean, what they've done on two fronts. First of all, they are protecting your information, so only the people that you send messages to can ever read those messages. In other words, WhatsApp can't read them themselves. Mm. Which is good for them in two ways. It's good for, first of all, because we don't have some creep from WhatsApp reading everything that we send each other. But also, it absolves them of responsibility if, you know, the police want to know what the content of your WhatsApp messages are.
No, that's
now, now they can't have it.
Well, you know, interestingly, I mean, Ben, you mentioned iPhone, and just a couple of days ago, it was reported that there is a bug in Siri, you know, Siri that you use. There's a bug in Siri that people have discovered basically allows anyone to hack into your phone so that they can spy on your photos and your contacts, your address book. Apparently, it's as simple as using Siri's ability to search Twitter to find an email address, which can then be used to open the iPhone's address book without entering a security code to unlock the phone. So, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
No, that just sounds that sounds like something they've got to sort out, because you know what I discovered yesterday as well? Someone posted something on Facebook. Apparently, everybody, you and Ben and Michael and everybody have got, there are a whole lot of messages that people have been sending you on Facebook over the years that you didn't even know you'd receive, that Facebook sort of filters out themselves. If you go into your Facebook Messenger and you go to Settings and you go to People, you'll open a whole can of, like, messages that Facebook has decided you didn't need to see.
Wow.
Go in there and look at it now. You'll suddenly see messages from, look, most of it is from, like, creeps that are, it's a good idea you didn't see these messages from. But a lot of them might even be people that have been trying to get hold of you.
Oh, so think of those girls that Michael stalked before he became a kept man.
Oh,
all those messages just
yeah.
going on deaf inboxes.
Flex, that's why some of those girls never responded to you. They didn't even get the message because Facebook just decided.
Imagine all the ones in Sia's inbox.
Oh, wow.
Oh. Wait, hang on a second, Gareth. She's opening Pandora's box here.
Are you checking them now?
We're trying to get, I think we're trying to get Sia on the mic. Is that what we're doing, Ben?
Yes.
But hold up. Do we know why Facebook did this? Why did they hide these messages exactly?
Well, they're not hiding them. Basically, there's a lot of trash that comes into your box that you actually don't need. You know, it's from sort of fake email addresses and from fake people, and a lot of it's bots and kind of spam and that kind of thing. So they're just trying to filter out the crap so you don't end up with a full inbox of messages every day from non-people, you know what I mean?
This has been around for years. We've just never noticed.
Exactly. So if you look at it, you can go all the way back. I mean, I didn't go back that far with the last year, but it's amazing how much stuff accumulates.
Wow.
And how many of them are requests the DJ at 14-year-old girls' birthday parties?
No, none, thank goodness.
Okay, well, that's reassuring.
Yeah, even they know enough to ask.
Ew. Ramos, what else we got in the news?
Well, you know, we like to walk around thinking that we've got real-life problems, right? And then,
all do. Yeah.
Well, yes. I mean, because some of us really do have genuine serious problems. But then other people, especially if you're in Hollywood, they've got first-world problems. And this is exactly what has been revealed in a British GQ magazine, where Charlize Theron basically complains about how she is just too beautiful for Hollywood. She's too beautiful for Hollywood.
Huh.
Yeah. The South African born. Oh, that's got to suck big time, Gareth.
What do you do about that?
Back on the sniff.
How do you tackle such a problem?
Well, we know that it sucks because obviously Charlize is dead broke. We know that she's living from couch to couch.
Could she be dead broke?
No, she's not. But I mean, this is exactly what I'm saying. It's that this woman has no problems. This woman has no problems, and I don't know what she's going on about here. But she says that she's too beautiful for Hollywood. And what that means is that if you are somebody who looks like her, you basically don't get any of the real roles in Hollywood, you know. You'll never get cast for the meaty roles. But here's my problem with Hollywood is that you have plenty of people who will, on the other side, complain that, well, if you're too ugly, then you just don't get put on the camera at all because they don't think that you're pretty enough.
Yeah, but hang on. Didn't she win her Oscar for playing someone ugly?
Yes, she did, Gareth. She put
so
on...
Stop it.
Yeah.
Stop talking shit.
Charlize gained 13 kilograms. She wore a prosthetic nose to play Eileen in the 2004 movie Monster, right? She went through this...
It was called Monster. I mean, what more do you want?
She went through this whole transformation, which is what a lot of actors have to do for their craft. I mean, you've often seen actors either lose half of their body weight, you know, to play some grief-stricken victim of the Holocaust, or you've seen people gain an excessive amount of weight, which is what Charlize did. It's required of your craft.
Or you fight a bear.
And she won the Oscar for that. And now here she's complaining about how I'm just too beautiful for Hollywood, and this is why I don't get given people. Any.
What do you want? I mean, what do you want, Charlize? What do you want? Would you like to be hideous and ugly? Would you like to look revolting?
I don't know what she wants. These are first world problems. These are not real problems. This all happened.
Go to the makeup department. You know, get someone to punch you in the face, and your nose will be all skew, and you can get all those rolls you always do.
This all happens in this month's edition of British GQ, where she's quoted as saying, "How many roles out there for the gorgeous, effing, gown-wearing 8-foot model?" When the Me Too...
Oh, don't worry, honey. Just hang on another 20 years and you'll get all the roles you want.
When the Me Too roles come through, I've been in the room and pretty people get turned away first. Exactly.
Oh, I'm so glad I'm not pretty.
Did she want the Jeffrey Tambor role in Transparent? I mean, what was she looking for?
I don't know what she wants, Gareth, and I don't know what she's complaining about. Her life is far from being less than admirable.
I reckon she's back on the sniff and she's just bored.
This is a first world problem if I've ever heard of one.
Yes, it
but
is.
On the note of Charlize, actually, a couple of weeks ago, she was under fire because paparazzi caught pictures of her and her son, Jackson, as they were getting into their car. Now, Jackson, mind you, is 3 or 4 years old. So you already know at that age, a child is already kind of chaotic. And she got scrutinized because she basically held her son at the wrist and forced him into the car. Now, that I can actually garner some sympathy for, because she's now being labeled this horrible person, and how dare you as a parent, you're abusing your child. And I mean, can we be honest, isn't that kind of unfair?
Yeah, of course it is. I mean, have you seen some of these children? They are basically
terrorists
in shopping centers, throwing tantrums, and their poor mothers.
Right, but not only that. I mean, didn't your parents push you around a little bit when you were kids?
Oh, exactly. Absolutely. I remember
But because you're not famous, nobody gets it. Everyone is like,
exactly. Exactly. I remember my sister with her son who threw a tantrum in the shopping center, and I got all nervous because people started to stare at us.
Yeah.
And I said to her, well, I mean, shouldn't we do something, like just carry him out of here? And she said, no. When he's done with his tantrum, he'll let me know. And she just walked away from him. And true, he stopped crying immediately when he realized that his mother was not paying attention to him. He just stopped crying.
That's the thing. But for an A-lister, it will be like, oh, you're abandoning your child, and everything gets blown way out of proportion.
Yeah,
I just think, you know what, parents, I never interfere with the way parents raise their kids. But when their kids become a problem to society, then someone's going to say something to them, just in case they're not aware. It doesn't have to be me, though. I'm not going to get involved. When kids start screaming and carrying on, I just leave. I just get the hell out of there. I can't handle it.
That's the best strategy, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, if they're your kids, because, then it's a problem to just leave.
Well, technically speaking.
See, the minute you open your mouth and start telling a parent that they're not the best parent in the world, you're inviting a universe of pain.
Yeah.
It's just not worth it.
But yeah, I still think condoms are the best strategy.
Listen, I don't know if you are aware that FNB has apparently shut down one of the business accounts that were held by a Gupta firm.
Ooh.
This was revealed yesterday when FNB said
that's
that
exciting.
They... Yes, well, is it? This was revealed yesterday when FNB shut down a South African company owned by the Guptas. They shut down their business account. This is the latest local company to shun the family due to the scandal of the Guptas' relationship with the president. Oak Bay Investment said in a statement that they received no reason whatsoever from FNB justifying their actions, and they say that they are already in the process of moving their accounts to what they call a more enlightened institution.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Oak Bay Investments, because yesterday morning after we spoke, I had to go back to my room to get something, and I turned on the TV, and there was a New Age breakfast being televised. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen any of these.
No.
Peter Ndoro was hosting it, so he was sitting there asking the questions.
question and looking really uncomfortable. And they had, this is the panel. Are you ready?
Sure.
All right. First of all, the CEO of Oak Bay Investments, some guy called Nazir something or another who works for the Guptas.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Then Mzwanele Mani, whose name used to be Jimmy, but who is an ANC stalwart through and through, and really doesn't have anything to say at the moment. I mean, he said five words during the whole New Age breakfast. It was a lot. It was all the same five words we've heard before. I support the president, exclamation mark.
This is the same guy who said, when the EFF first announced that they were taking the president to the Constitutional Court, this was the same guy who said, oh, please, the courts will dismiss you. It's not even going to be an issue.
So this guy's credibility is like, it's not only gone under the bridge and disappeared down the river, it's now in the ocean and it's sitting at the bottom with the rocks and the crabs and the prawns and all the other detritus at the very, very lowest point of the Marianas Trench. So low is his current credibility. So Mzwanele Mani, who really nobody should listen to anymore, he's one of the guests on the panel. Because now, you know, it's a New Age breakfast. That's on SABC.
Yeah.
So they desperately need people who can still toe the line, even though there's zero that you can say about the current administration that is friendly and positive. Anyway, so Mzwanele Mani. The next one is Claudi Motsweneng.
Oh, yes.
Is he still on unpaid leave? Well, sorry, paid leave.
He, of course, said very little as well, mostly because he's completely inarticulate and can't string more than three words together without fucking it up royally. Okay, that's two. Number three was a woman who is called Pinky Khwabani on Twitter. We've spoken to Pinky once or twice, but she also is running out of steam now because she says, for example, but state capture is not really a big deal with the Guptas because Afrikaans people really run the economy. You know, they're not the ones who are holding our executives in the palm of their hand and getting exactly what they want from the president. But she somehow still thinks that, you know, the Rupits, for example, are a bigger problem than the Guptas.
So for her,
she's completely in the dark.
So for her, it's a case of the lesser of two evils.
Correct. And she's one of those people who's always, you know, she can't imagine that black people could actually make a decision for themselves. That this has to be white people manipulating black people. And if not white people, Indian people. But in this case, it doesn't suit her to say Indian people because she's also the president's woman. And she will say whatever she needs to keep the president on side. So that's number three. Then there was a guy called Leon Lowe from the Free Market Association who tried to say one or two interesting things. But every time he did, he was like shouted down. And there was absolutely nothing about this discussion that was useful or interesting. Nothing. I've never watched such a boring 20 minutes or whatever it was of TV. I was horrified that they should even do this. And do you know that not one commercial advert was played during the course of that entire thing?
Oh,
not one.
That's quite daring.
There were two promo breaks. And the time that I watched, there were two promo breaks. They were filled with promos instead of commercials. No one is buying airtime on the SABC during New Age breakfast, which means that they're being funded entirely by the Guptas. Now tell me that isn't ridiculous.
Sure. Well, that is interesting what you mentioned about the fact that there was no advertising there because, you know, apart from the story of F&B shutting down this one business account by Oak Bay Investments, KPMG and Barclays Africa have also severed ties with the firm owned by the Guptas. So, you know, with the whole FIFA scandal, you often hear Ben saying that sponsors really need to develop a conscience and decide where it's necessary to pull out their money. And so maybe we need to start having the same conversation in this debacle, you know, with
regards. You know what, Mads, it's what you were saying yesterday. Citizens have to take action now.
Yeah.
Ordinary people in South Africa, and that includes the owners of businesses, the shareholders in businesses, the boards of directors in businesses. We all have to say, look, to here and no further, we take ourselves seriously as a country, and we're not going to allow, you know, this kind of manipulation.
Damn right. Damn right.
Hello?
Yeah, hi, Gareth. You're doing very well.
Oh, sorry.
Lance is fine.
I thought I'd lost you for a second there.
When do you get behind the camera? We still have you for a little bit.
Sorry?
When do you get behind the camera? Do we still have you for a little bit?
You've got another 2-3 minutes, I'm sure.
Okay.
You can keep going if you want to.
All right, Mel.
I did want to ask you, because I missed it. We were obviously busy, but did Justice have anything to say about all this mess in Parliament that was particularly interesting? I mean, he's always got interesting stuff to say.
Yeah, it was a very sort of curtailed 45 minutes, Gareth. I think everything was kind of covered.
Well, I think
I'll download the podcast.
The most interesting thing that I took away from Justice this morning was come August 3rd, it's going to be interesting to see how Tshwane votes in these local government elections, because as it stands, the ANC's hold in Tshwane is already down to 49%. And he predicts that, if the EFF and the DA get enough votes, there could be grounds for them to have, you know, to form some kind of alliance, some kind of coalition that then obviously makes them as the opposition a stronger hold, than the ANC in Tshwane. And he says he reckons that when that happens, Gwede Mantashe will be giving Julius Malema a call saying, all right, listen, guy, let's the two of us partner up. And then the DA will also be interested to give Julius a call and say, no, let the two of us partner up and run this municipality together. Which kind of puts Julius Malema and the EFF in, you know, in a nice seat. Like they could basically.
It does. It gives them real power, because, you know, people just look at the numbers and they go, oh, well, you know, they've got like 7 or 8% if they're lucky in places like Tshwane. But 7 or 8% is the deal breaker if you need to form a coalition government.
Yeah.
Or the deal maker. And that could be interesting. I very much doubt at this stage that Julius wants anything to do with Gwede or with the ANC, not in their current state.
Well, maybe he'll have to put that aside and think of the greater good and, you know, put his personal feelings aside.
I saw a really nice picture yesterday. Well, two really nice pictures. The one was of Musiwa Lekota, Bantu Holomisa, and Mangosuthu Buthelezi standing together outside Parliament on the day of this big debate 2 days ago. And the other one was of Musi and Julius, sort of shaking hands and laughing in Parliament. And, you know, again, I've just got to say, whichever opposition party you are supporting, if it's not, you know, the ANC, and if you are supporting the ANC, I suppose you have your reasons. But at this point, I feel like there's a new energy in our politics, and we need to take advantage of this.
Yeah, I hope so. Gareth, before we get to the, we're going to get to interview quite shortly. Something I want to bring up, Clint from the Vaal just reminded me of it. You know that with the West Indies cricket, right? Those guys went there with no support from the board, the administrators, anything like that. So now that they've come home, Darren Sammy, the 32-year-old captain of the team, has just had a cricket ground named after him. It is now the Darren Sammy Ground. And Johnson Charles, one of the players, is now the Johnson Charles stand. These guys are covering their asses so quickly. It's like, oh, we've always been big fans of you. Yeah, here's a ground slime for you.
What slime?
Oh, these guys, huh?
Everybody always wants to be seen with the hot girl or the popular guy.
Sports administrators are like the lowest. They're the lowest.
They're the worst.
The lowest sports administrators.
They are the absolute, absolute worst. Gareth, we've got Brett Innes coming up next in the interview. Do you want to just say a couple of words about that?
Which interview is it?
The Brett Innes interview.
I don't really have an intro. I mean, you know, we wouldn't waste your time and put a shitty interview together, so take a listen. There are lots of interesting people that we've spoken to in the last couple of days, and this is no exception.
Okay.
I'm just going to say, like, you know, we've had some real movers and shakers talk to us, and I feel like we get to hear the stories of South Africans, prominent ones, less prominent South Africans, people who have just great stories to tell, and we don't have to rush them, we don't have to interrupt them. This guy is a filmmaker, and he's managed to take a book that he wrote and turn it into a movie, which is something very few people get right. He's managed to secure a reasonably okay budget for that movie, which is even more difficult to get right. And it turns out he's quite an interesting dude too, because the story that he's decided to tell is the story of a woman from Mozambique who's a domestic worker, and she loses her child, and she has to kind of put up with being the maid in this house, and, you know, the people that she works with, she has this love-hate relationship the people she works for, she has this love-hate relationship with. And it's just kind of interesting that a white guy should write a story like this. And he wrote it in Afrikaans, and it's an Afrikaans movie, but it's from the point of view of this woman, this domestic worker. So it's fascinating. I mean, you know, to be able to do that, to be able to write something like that, you have to have a huge and vivid imagination. And you have to be able to tell it with some kind of reality, which is incredible. So he's done a lot of research around it. I think people will be interested.
Super. Wonderful. Guys, we're going to go to a song now. We're going to come back with the interview. Same time tomorrow. We're going to catch you from the start of the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything will be back to normal tomorrow. And then we're back in the studio on Monday.
Fantastic. I'm sure you're very excited to be coming home.
Oh, you have no idea. Wait till I tell you all about the Wild Coast.
All right, cool.
All right.
Right, Brett Innes coming up next. Interview with Gareth in the last hour of the show. And the sun is out in Joburg. Woohoo!
There's children on the street using guns and knives. They're taking drugs and each other's lives.
CliffCentral.com.
CliffCentral.com. We're talking to interesting people in South Africa. There's a brand new book out by Brett Michael Innes. It is called Rachel Weeping. He's already had a really successful book, The Story of Rachel Gidebier, which I hope this isn't some rehash. You've even used the same name. Come on, what's wrong with you?
It is not, and I don't have an obsession with the name of Rachel.
It sounds like you do. Now, your latest book is called Rachel Weeping, and it is a novel.
Correct.
I don't read a lot of fiction, but I've got to tell you that this is, and I really only managed to breeze through most of it last night. It's a very moving story. It's a very complicated story. And I think, look, you're an interesting guy. We're going to talk to you about your life in a second or two. But this is a story of a woman who has to make really difficult choices.
Correct.
A woman whose personal life is extremely complicated. There are issues that we are dealing with in South African society, whether it's poverty, whether it's racism, whether it's to do with inequality, someone who works for someone else, maids and madams, that kind of thing. But it's also got to do with, you know, the death of a child. I mean, it's a hard, this is a hard life that this Rachel has.
Yeah. No, it's a tough one. I think at the heart of it, it deals with a universal event of losing a child, something that everyone can identify with. And then on the circumference of this narrative is everything that you've described, these relationships between people who work in our houses cleaning up after us. A lot of conversation I think that's taking place in South Africa comes to light in this novel, and I hope it's done in a way that doesn't necessarily polarize. I think it asks more questions than gives answers and holds up a mirror as opposed to pointing fingers.
You have to be very brave as a writer to go into some of this territory, particularly as a white guy writing about kind of the pain that someone like your character Rachel will feel and the things that she's going through. I mean, you haven't lost a child. You don't know what it's like to be a domestic worker. You explain and you articulate and you describe very beautifully how that must feel, how that must be, which is incredible. I mean, it must take an almost out-of-body experience for you to be able to explain the life of this woman in the way that you do. And you write very beautifully for what it's worth, but it must be something that worries you because you have to be extremely brave to go into these areas and worry that, oh, you're going to be accused of, you know, all kinds of things. In South Africa at the moment, you can't say anything without pissing someone off.
Yeah.
Were you worried that you're trying to tell the story of someone who you really aren't and can't necessarily stereotypically relate to?
Yeah, I think it's something that was in the back of my mind, but I think that's where research comes in. I mean, often there's two schools of thought. The one is that you write what you know, which is like when you get Khalid Hosseini writing Kite Runner, he's writing textures of Afghanistan, of experiences that he's had. And I think that's quite helpful because you are able to paint a picture in a way that people from the outside necessarily maybe couldn't. But
isn't that a beautiful book?
Exquisite. Such a gorgeous one.
That was the first time I really kind of connected with Afghanistan reading that book. I'm sorry that we're on a bit of a tangent here, but,
yeah,
but this is that whole the way that kid grows up, his father, the relationship with that friend of his who he loses contact with, the destruction of that country around him. It's just unbelievably beautifully done. And again, he's writing from some level of experience, whereas you are telling stories that aren't necessarily yours.
Correct. I mean, I am, and in, by all accounts, completely unqualified to tell this story, which I think that's where it comes down to research, because if I didn't do that, I feel I would have painted a very generic surface level portrayal of what it is to be a foreign national domestic worker or a Afrikaans woman struggling with infertility.
Right.
Yeah, I'm a single white gay male who really has no experience in any of these spaces other than the fact that I've
seen
that.
How do you research this stuff?
For me, I worked in documentary film for quite a while, so I've driven to Sudan from Johannesburg twice, gone into malnutrition clinics in Angola, like really saturated myself for about 2-3 years in the lives of people who are coming to Johannesburg, to South Africa, to literally save their families. The gardeners, the car guards, the maids who work in our houses, I was able to see kind of where they came from. And I met so many Rachels along the way, which, yeah, they all blended together to become this woman. And then I think for the other two characters, I was just able to look at my friends. I could see my subculture, the upper LSM of 8 to 10 white male, female experience. And then I'm in my 30s now, so you start to see people, friends, having those conversations around having kids, buying houses, becoming responsible adults, and to see how those worlds then just collide, because it is a South African thing that I think we can all identify with. And I think the research was just living in it and listening. I think that's the biggest thing, is if you want to tell a story, you actually need to know how to listen first so that you can find it.
That's spot on, but it's easier said than done.
Totally easier.
I was looking at your CV. Brett is extraordinarily well-traveled. I mean, you've been to places that I don't think a lot of people, except maybe Africa reporters, would go to. South Sudan?
Yeah, pretty insane.
What the hell drew you to a place like South Sudan?
I was working with NGOs, so they were taking a brick-making machine up there, and they needed someone to document it. I could film and edit, so I took my camera and my laptop and... yeah, I jumped on a convoy of cars and we went up there. I mean, going into South Sudan itself, there was actually no space in the vehicles for me, so I ended up on the back of a Land Cruiser with about 10 SPLA soldiers.
Wow.
For about 2 days, just driving through. Yeah.
What's the place like?
It's like going back in time. Honestly, literally people walking around tribal skins with cattle camps. Yeah, there's absolutely nothing that we recognize from even our rural experience in South Africa. You do not see any of that. So it is like,
would the people of South Sudan know what the laptop was?
Not at all. I think the fact that maybe you saw, they knew what a Coca-Cola was because in Juba, the capital, that you have foreign aid workers who go there. But I mean, in the camp we were in, to literally see tribesmen coming in with Legavans and cane rats on a stick, and that's what they were eating. Yeah. Gorgeous space, very intimidating, I think, to just what my experience is growing up and going into a war zone. Then, I mean, going into Sudan when we were camped in Kenya, we had militia fire into the camp. And,
it is a violent place.
Totally. I shut myself a bit.
It's not pleasant.
Not at all.
You don't go in there and think, oh, this is a great holiday. You're sitting like you're poolside at a resort. No. And Juba, what's that place like?
We drove past Juba, so we went about 2 days further into, I guess it's kind of on the cusp of where the militia control stuff and where the South Sudan government was doing stuff. They hadn't actually split the country in two, so there was a lot of instability at that stage.
This is still before they had their independence?
Correct, yeah. I think it's actually more problematic now, because now there's a lot of infighting within the South.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just insane space.
You've also been to, I mean, this is amazing. You worked kind of with NGOs, but you were mostly doing filming.
Yeah, all the time. Yeah.
For all these things. So you were in Angola, Tanzania, Mozambique, Malawi, Mongolia, Sierra Leone, DRC, Nepal, Liberia, Lesotho, Zambia, Zimbabwe. I mean, this is an incredible list of places, and I'm only going through half of it. What do you see in a place like Mongolia? I mean, that's a hell of a way from here.
Yeah.
It's north of China. It's known for the desert, Gobi Desert. It's known for Kublai and Genghis Khan.
Yeah.
And that's about it. What can you tell me about Mongolia?
Just when I went there, the temperature dropped to about minus 40. I've never seen cold like that before. When you go take a pee outside, like literally there's just steam everywhere.
Wow.
I was in Ulaanbaatar, the capital, for a couple of days. And then there was an orphanage that we were filming some stuff around there. And then one of the friends of the NGO, I think he stays about 3 hours out into more of the rural space. You drive past this huge Genghis Khan statue, which looks like Lord of the Rings. And he's this blind pastor that actually leads a nomadic church, which the irony of that is I loved. But they needed people to chop down trees so they'd have firewood for the winter. So ended up having horse meat for breakfast, lunch and supper because everyone's wanting to feed you. And we went in with this group and chopped down some trees and got firewood to him, which was one of the most bizarre like weeks of my life.
What an experience though.
Yeah. Oh, I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
Do you manage when you're in places like this? I mean, you sound like someone who's really interested in figuring out local cultures and kind of, you know, discovering things about local peoples in these places that you've been to. But do you ever come back with a feeling of, wow, I'm really happy I'm in South Africa? Because it's hard not to when you've been to some of the most tough places, like South Sudan and Mongolia are not easy places to live in.
I think it gives you also a perspective on poverty, which is perhaps different because if we have an experience here in South Africa because we drive past squatter camps, we have street beggars on street corners. But when you go into places where literally there is no food, surprisingly, you don't see any begging. If you do, it's really like a 8-month pregnant woman. It's so desperate that everyone actually is just doing their own thing. There's that community vibe of sharing and stuff. But I think I feel definitely the privilege that I have in South Africa, the access that I have, it gives you a perspective on, I think a lot of South Africans who haven't traveled feel like Europe or the US really has their shit together. But we really have a lot going on for us here. And so I appreciate it. But I mean, I'm just a wanderlust kind of person. I need a new space in my life every couple of months, you know.
Jeez, do you think you'll ever settle down and just have a base and leave it for holidays?
Joburg's actually become a bit of that. I think I've enjoyed that.
Are you from Joburg?
Yeah, born and raised, yeah. Huh? I mean, what was nice is I stayed in the CBD this December for about 2 months, which was really cool. I love the space. While writing and actually the film that the book is based on, while producing that,
you did the film first and you've written the book as a subsequent.
Write them simultaneously. So script and book at the same time. And yeah, the movie came out this week, last week actually, which was, it's been really well received.
Congratulations, Jeff.
Thanks.
You should go and see it. I thought there was only a book. You see how uninformed I am? No, this is impressive. Let's go to the book for a second because, the story of this Rachel is horrible.
Mm.
She has a child and the family she works for are expecting a child.
Yes.
And then something happens to her kid. Yeah. And it's actually the fault of the family that she works with.
The SA family, yeah.
Right. And now she has to choose whether she can go back to Malawi.
Mozambique.
Mozambique, and live the life of poverty there and try to scrape together a living and try to rebuild her life with zero. Or she can stay here, bear this horrible, negative, nasty feeling that she gets from this family and think all the time of how they've contributed to the death of her child.
Mm.
And grin and bear it and actually, you know, kind of try and make a living here.
Yeah.
And she chooses to do that.
Yeah. What's so interesting is part of my research was explaining the story to or asking different
people. And
she's
dealing with all of this in an environment of xenophobia, of racism,
correct,
of poverty, of everything.
Yeah, yeah. The research was asking different people what they thought about this. So if I asked people from LSM of 8 to 10, they really were like, wow, that's a very hectic situation to find yourself in. I don't know if I could work for the people responsible for the death of my child. Then speaking to Zimbabwean domestic workers, they were like, I know people who have stayed for so much worse just so they can keep their visa paper. So what I love is the story idea just brings so many layers and perspectives that you perhaps don't even consider, because from an incredibly empowered place, you couldn't imagine doing this kind of thing. From an unempowered space, it makes complete sense.
So you had to use the perspective of a completely different human being, something that you couldn't even relate to.
Correct.
To try and understand, why would a woman do this?
It's to support her family in Mozambique. In the narrative, she's looking after her parents. She's actually a qualified nurse in Mozambique, jeez, but cannot find work. So comes to South Africa and ends up working as a domestic worker. It's, yeah, to keep that visa, to keep, it's her home because she lives on site, on the property with her employers. And I think what I really try to do, and I feel it's been successful, is not to go the obvious route. And that is to polarize and to paint the cruel white couple who is rich and the suffering poor black Mozambican. The couple who employ her are incredibly kind. They pay for the private school education of her daughter. There's this interesting, I wouldn't say camaraderie. I think if they're born in the same LSM and group,
it's an interesting symbiosis.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there is that professional distance. And I've made Rachel also, there's stuff that she does, which is actually inexcusable as well. She's got her shades of gray in her. And I just love that we're able to show that.
But this is what's hard about human relations, right? Is that nothing is one dimensional.
Exactly.
And really looking at it from both points of view is sometimes very difficult for people to do.
Correct.
Because we always choose a side.
Yeah.
And we find the stories and the characteristics that support our preconceived notions of what people are like. So when you talk about this family that she's working for, there are a lot of South Africans, white South Africans, I think, who can relate to the fact that probably the first person that they connected with might have been the domestic worker who looked after them while their mother or father weren't around so much. And then later on, they learn that this person is actually not family.
Yeah.
And it becomes a very difficult relationship to figure out as a kid.
Yeah.
Right?
It's an insane one. And I think added to that is like a layer that I've added is that the daughter who goes to private school education, she thinks she lives with Rachel's daughter. She thinks she lives with the wealthy family and talks to the other kids about her, the swimming pool that she has. Rachel doesn't come in a domestic worker outfit to pick her up from school. So all the other moms think she's just one of them, you know?
Yeah.
So it's this complex layer of, I think with the domestic worker gardener relationship as well, it's one of the few employer employee dynamics where there's this expectation that you look after that person more than you would say a plumber or someone else who provides you with the service. And I think I love asking these questions within the space where you flip it and then also ask, you have the thing of a minimum wage, but what is a working wage? And to see how the wealthy are take advantage of the system.
And especially of foreigners.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, there are lots of people in South Africa who will do anything for work.
Correct. Yeah.
You know, for some money.
Yeah.
You know, it's an amazing, I say it's very brave of you to take on subject matter like this. So with the movie, have you found all the people for the various roles? You must be well into production. I mean,
well, the film came out.
It's done.
It's released. It's actually been listed as one of the top 10 Afrikaans films made to date. The reviews have been.
And you've done it in Afrikaans.
Incredible. Yeah. So I describe them as an Afrikaans family in the book. I'm an English writer. So for me to write in Afrikaans would be a pictured book. It wouldn't have worked out.
But that's another stretch you've decided to take.
I love it because what I've seen, and there's a scene in the movie where the couple are Afrikaans, so naturally it's their language that they talk to each other in, so they will talk to each other in Afrikaans in front of Rachel, who doesn't understand the language, another barrier that we put in place. What's interesting, though, is that between Rachel's got her friends who are from Malawi and Zimbabwe, and they all speak English together because they don't speak each other's local tongue. And so the movie becomes this mix of languages. It's called Sync. So we changed the title from Rachel Weeping to Sync, which can be Sync in Afrikaans as well. And it just looks at all these layers that actually build up to separate us from each other.
Do you think after doing all this research, after putting the movie and the book together, do you think that we've got a way of figuring out these relationships that we have in South Africa between, first of all, parents and children, families that employ someone who works for someone as a domestic worker? Do you think there's any way we'll figure this out? Do you think it can be done in a positive way?
Yeah.
Or do you think there'll always be people taken advantage of? There'll always be lying. There'll always be pretending.
Yeah. I think my hope is that it adds to that conversation so that we see each other in individual capacities, because I think we want to fix this as a whole. But if we just look at our own individual relationship with domestic workers, if we employ them, and domestic workers with their employers, I don't think it's this thing that it's the wealthy who have to fix from their side only. It's this, both are in the space where it's a system that they're part of. They could have been born into it. They're still responsible because they're part of it. I really feel, and the feedback on the film and the book is that it adds to the national conversation that is taking place, but in a way that doesn't leave people feeling demonized, but rather encourages them to be reflective. And I think out of that place, you're willing to have conversations with yourself to make changes. But as soon as you're attacked, you become defensive. And when you're defensive, you fight. And if the goal is to start a fight, then okay, that's how you end up. But if the goal is actually to build bridges and find each other, then we need to listen a lot more and to be willing to be wrong. I think within my own space and my own reflections on myself, it's one of the hardest things to realize that you are part of the system and you are at an advantage, and how you can either change things that you do or ways that you do, to, you know, see another person to help.
It's deep stuff. What's your next book going to be? You're going to be Caitlyn Jenner?
Not yet.
It's complex stuff, man. No, I think that there's probably a lot of lessons in this, but it's also a beautiful story. And, you know, sometimes people need to escape from reality. So that there's an element of climbing into the different characters and living through them, which is always nice in fiction. And I think a lot of people pick up books because they don't want to have to deal with their own situation. What's the reason that you do this kind of writing? You could have chosen to do a lot. Yeah. There are 23 different things that you could have done that would have been much easier than this.
I think if the movies that move me the most, stories as well, book stories, are the ones that make me feel and sit with me for a while. And I think I just have a natural inclination towards this kind of story. I think in my personal capacity as well, I'm have a slightly activist-y personality. So it's always thoughts that are bouncing around in my head. So to actually have them manifest in characters, to be able to explore it within the realm of fiction. I think when we watch stories, we also not defensive. We're just watching a story play out. And yet again, like the inception point for me with the story, it was never anything to do with the dynamics of power or anything. It was the loss of a child. Yeah. That is the thing that birthed this whole journey for me.
Universal human.
That's it. Everyone gets it. Everyone empathizes with the mother who has lost a child.
You're involved. You mentioned just a moment ago that, you know, you're a bit of an activist. You're a lot of an activist. You're involved with joint aid management. You provide food and water relief to a number of sub-Saharan African countries. So how much of your time does that take up?
Not so much in the last year, but I've done a lot of trips with them. So a lot of the NGO work where I was documenting what they were doing was into these spaces, and it was with JAM. Actually, Rachel was originally from Zimbabwe, but on a trip to Mozambique with them, because water plays such a big role in this film, I was actually has to come from a place where the water is what it is in Vilankulos. So we've walked a long road with each other to see the kind of work that they are doing. They do much more than I do. I come along and chop some things together, and it shows people what they do. So there's other people in that organization who really pour themselves in. But it's a journey that I've really appreciated.
Now, tell me about this previous book of yours, because that also you did very well, and people were very impressed with that.
Yeah, it's the old folk tale of Rachel Kidabia.
She's the girl who she dug a hole and she kind of cuddled her little brother, and he lived and she died.
Correct. She took off all her clothes in a snowstorm and put them in front of a termite heap and crammed them into there. For me it was, I'm an English person telling one of the most loved Afrikaans folk tales.
I mean,
what right do I have to do that? What I love is, I think when you're external, you don't come with a defensiveness to defending your culture in your art, or you have a slightly more objective approach because you're not trying to have a message within your space.
It's just a beautiful story, right?
And that is it. I mean, as an English person, it touched me as a kid when I heard the story and was genuinely surprised that it had never been fleshed out or explored, and put some words on paper. And my model for at least these two projects has always been to do this film screenplay while writing the novel. And the screenplay has been picked up by other producers.
What's the difference, by the way, between writing a screenplay and writing a novel?
I guess like squash and tennis. They're similar, but they do have distinct differences. With a script, there's certain structural things that you really need to hit so that there's entertainment value, that there's an emotional journey for the audience. And also just one page equals 1 minute of screen time. So,
oh, really? Is that how it works?
You generally don't want to go over 90 pages if you want to hit the 1 hour, 1.5 hour film length. With a novel, you really do have the room to explore the poetry of the thinking of the characters. You have more time, more space. So, much broader place. I think my natural inclination is to script writing. I found it more of a stretch to write poetically in my novels because my training was more in screenwriting. But I just love how they complement each other. With Rachel Weeping, to be able to give the actors, before the book had even come out, to give them the book to read, it was like this director's Bible where they could just really see how I thought the characters were accessing things, which you could never explore in the script. The script is a skeleton. And then all the other, the camera departments, the production designers all come together and add flesh to it.
How expensive is it to put this together as a movie?
Jeez, the movie, we had your average essay budget of just under 5 million, so, which...
It sounds like a lot, but it doesn't go far, right?
We really tightened our belts to make this thing happen, and Cakenet came on board with the pre-sale, so they read the screenplay, loved it, and traditionally they wait for the end product to be made, and then they buy it, but they're like, no, we'll throw some money in this up front.
That's impressive.
Yeah, no, it really, it's great having a brand like that behind the project.
But it also means that you're developing some serious cred in making movies, which means that it'll be easier for you every time to make a new one, right?
Correct. I mean, the next one, we actually had a crew meeting yesterday. It's an international production, international cast.
Wow.
Historical epic.
Good for you.
Thanks. No, I'm a happy man.
That's very good. You know, for so many people in movie making in South Africa, it's a part-time thing. It's not a full-time job. It must be quite satisfying to know that you're doing this. This is your work.
Correct. I mean, I really, for many years, I quit full-time employment, did work, which, I mean, you could focus and try and make money. I tightened my belt. I've gone into the red so many times just to make this thing happen. And about a year before we actually hit into production, I was like, I'm giving this one more year. Otherwise, I'm quitting this thing, because what you give up just to try and make it happen is quite a lot. You give up on opportunities to travel, to do other things. And yeah, it comes a point, I think, in every artist's life where they have to assess whether the journey is worth the cost. And fortunately, it's worked out for me, I think.
Good for you.
Yeah.
What's the end game? I mean, do you want to be producing full-length feature films for Hollywood?
The next one is with A-list actors. I can't say the names.
Amazing.
So, like,
are you going to be producing, directing, the whole lot?
Writing and directing. I mean, the dream is just to write and direct. And this company loved the film that Rachel Weeping's that is based on Rachel Weeping. Uh-huh. And yeah, so I didn't stuff that one up and got me my next job. And they're producing it for me, so I don't have to do any
of
that.
Look at you. You're on your way to being credited with the Academy Awards one day.
Oh, I hope so.
That's terrific.
Yeah.
Well, listen, dude, all the best. And please, no more Rachels. That's the only thing.
That's it. I'm cutting it out.
That's if we can just stick to other names. There are lots of other women in the world besides Rachels. But well done to you. This is really, really special stuff. And I'm glad that there's another story of South African success in filmmaking.
Thank you.
We need more of these. And it seems like the tide is turning. We're starting to produce stuff that punches at the required weight and above, which is great. Well done to you.
Thanks, sir.
Good luck with the writing as well. Stop doing that.
Hells yeah.
Nice thing, I suppose, is you can keep doing that until you're 100 years old.
Exactly.
Right? I'll be writing films then. All right, there we go. It's very interesting. Brett Michael Innes, and he's leaving for the UK on the 26th. What are you doing there?
2 months of US, UK, France. It's a film is official selection for the Atlanta Film Festival. We're going to the Cannes market, meeting with cast in London. So
awesome.
It's a good combo. Yeah.
Sure. All right. You let us know as soon as you can about who those A-list actors in your next film are going to be.
I will do so.
You better. All right. Very, very good. He's the author of Rachel Weeping. The film adaptation of Rachel Weeping is called Sink, and it begins screening in cinemas nationwide 18 March. And this is an amazing accomplishment, not only for South African writing and South African movie making, but also in terms of a really great story that you can go and be a part of and share in the experience of. Awesome stuff. CliffCentral.com.
That was Gareth talking to Brett Innes. If you missed any of that, then catch the podcast on CliffCentral.com. You get everything there. Michael, how the podcast going out today? Much smoother?
Much smoother. All the technology here is working. No flaws as of yet. But touch wood.
What a treat. See you get your hands out of your pants.
That's nice, because we had like an army in here yesterday trying to fix the problems that we were dealing with. So, you know.
Getting it done.
You expect results.
But that's life. Like 50 senses in one of his songs.
No.
You wouldn't know sunshine if it wasn't for rain.
Okay.
You wouldn't know hurt. I mean, you wouldn't know happiness if it wouldn't for pain.
Yeah, I don't think.
I
don't think it was just 50 that said the sunshine and the rain.
Yeah, I don't think that's his thing.
Since Michael mentioned 50 Cent right now, can we actually talk about some hectic celebrities who had even hectic-er pasts? well, not really even hectic celebrities. Some people we know as like these clean cut, pure, wonderful people like Mark Wahlberg. You know, we all know who he is. He's a Hollywood actor.
Marky Mark.
Yes. You know, he was even a rapper back in these days. Mm. But I think we've all forgotten that he actually had one of the craziest teenage years around. So Mark Wahlberg, by the age of 13, had actually been in trouble with the police department around 24 times. 24 times by the age of 13. So he was addicted to cocaine and other substances as well. By 15, there was a civil action against him because he was involved in two separate incidences of harassing African-American school children. I'm just like, now we all love him. We see him in 10. We laugh along with him. But the dude at 15 was committing these crimes. By 16, Mark Wahlberg was charged with attempted murder.
What?
When he assaulted two separate Vietnamese men. Now, Michael, that's what true thuggery is.
Yeah, he used to steal cars as well.
Attempted murder at 16 years old. He was, he pled guilty, so he only served about 45 days of a 2-year sentence.
Oh, that's a nice light.
That's a noble thing to do.
Light sentences.
And if you didn't have abs, you'd still be in that life.
If you need to know some more, Jay-Z, of course, I think we can all sort of expect this from him. Yeah. He was 12 years old when he shot his older brother.
Thug life. Thug life right over there.
For what? Why did he? What did his brother do to him that he had to be shot?
I have no idea. Listen, the only way we know about it is through one of his songs where he actually rapped. He says, I saw the devil in your eyes. Highs off more than weed. Confused. I just closed my young eyes and squeezed.
Oh, so he was high in that moment.
That is so hectic.
He was never charged for a crime for that shooting. And then lastly, this is kind of very close to home, Michael. You know, if you want to carry on with this thug life, Vanilla Ice.
Vanilla Ice. There is no way Vanilla Ice was a thug.
Yes, he has like bad street cred to him. He's been arrested twice. But for him, it was his first arrest in 2004 when he actually pled guilty to this. He was charged of disorderly conduct and he was sentenced to probation. And then 4 years later, he was arrested for domestic battery after his wife called the police and said Vanilla was hitting and kicking her. And the police asked why. And she just said, well, he started yelling at me for going out to buy a bedroom set in front of my daughter.
Bitch.
Hashtag thug life.
I think Jay-Z takes a cake. I did not know that.
Shooting your own brother at 12 years old.
Dude. Well, yeah, everybody has got a past, hey?
Speaking of thugs, can you guys identify this one?
Yeah, another guy said, but I tell you what, you won't see me moving to no African jungle anytime soon. Or some goddamn desert somewhere sitting on a carpet with a bunch of Arabs? No, sir. And you won't see me stop eating no ribs either.
Please don't tell me that.
Isn't that Obama?
It sounds like Obama.
It sounds like
pussy
him.
Too. Don't Malcolm talk about no pussy? Now you know that ain't gonna work.
Mm-mm. It's an Obama impersonator.
Yes.
Is that the final answer?
That can't be Obama.
It's Obama at the age of 33.
Oh my God.
Yeah. No, that's Obama talking at University of Cambridge, I think it is.
Are you sure?
Did he say the P word?
Exactly. That's what I was thinking as well.
Yeah, it's Obama.
He would not.
Guys, it's a video. You can go onto YouTube right now. Type in Obama says, gotta love them ribs and pussy too.
Oh, okay. Well, look.
But he's quoting from a book.
Context. Or is he?
That's the thing. Is he or isn't he quoting from a book? Or does he just love ribs and pussy?
You guys can talk about him. He's your cool president. I told you. From the beginning. Should be more dignified as a president. Go ahead. Defend him now. Using the P word.
He was 33.
I have no reason to waste my time defending the American president when I'm trying to deal with my president.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we've got bigger
really
problems.
Priorities.
We'd love for him to be half as eloquent
time.
Yeah, exactly.
It reminds me of when, it must have been like 6 years ago, when Donald Trump was on WWE and he came into the ring and I think he knocked somebody out and then he shaved Vince McMahon's hair. Oh my God. Those days.
Wow. Michael, yesterday you were quite excited about telling the story we didn't have any time for though, about a robot.
Yeah, so I'm chilled with robots taking over outsource or non-core activities, stuff like that. You can host the restaurants, you can run hotels. But in Japan, they've developed a sex suit now. It's designed to work alongside a game called Sexy Beach, which is basically anime girls with huge with huge boobs and they have sex with you. The suit uses Oculus Rift and a masturbation device called Tenga in conjunction to stimulate the act of physical sex. Mm. And it's got sensors. You wear a suit that makes you feel like people are touching you. And then it's got like a pair of boob-like appendages to play with during the session.
Man, Japan's so cool.
Dude, I want to go to Japan. I keep saying this and people think that I'm weird, but those people are miles ahead of the rest of the world when it comes to just being liberated. And I mean, you want to call it weird stuff, but it's really impressive the kind of stuff that they do in Japan.
I won't lie, I also kind of want to go to see the technology there.
But I mean, we kind of predicted that this would be the next step, right, in terms of where technology is going, is that eventually one day you're going to be able to have sex by yourself.
Don't you feel like someone actually just needs to set, like, this is where the line is drawn?
Yeah.
No.
Like, next minute we're going to have robot cops that we have no control over. One guy will be in control of all RoboCops via computers.
I'd far rather that than a fake robot. Yeah, nope, doesn't sound right.
Sorry, can we just get back to the line of self-sex? Is there ever going to be a line for that, or is that just an old play?
Well, that's kind of sad to me, though.
That's where we're headed.
Because you kind of ask the question, if that's the future, you know, is that a bad thing or is it a good thing? Because this person could be an axe murderer. But if he has a night at home with his sex suit, he's
then
good.
It'll calm him down.
Come tomorrow, he's good. He's back in his cubicle. He's getting shit done.
Yeah, he de-stresses.
But what happens when it gets to a point where these sex robots are so much better than a normal person at sex, where we don't want to have sex with other people, then there's no more babies and the population just dies out and we don't see it happening.
That's okay. I keep saying we as humans need to be wiped out ASAP, so I don't have an issue with the human population going down drastically.
In a great TV shows get cancelled all the time. I think the humans can also maybe not get renewed.
Yeah, I mean,
I think we're way far from actually worrying about the population, so it's fine. That's a worry for another day.
Would you say they invented a robot that's a pilot to fly a plane? Would you let it fly your plane?
Yes.
I mean, as it stands, planes do go onto autopilot, in which case the computer takes over.
Yeah, I mean, I told you my story at the start of the show about my Uber trip here. A robot can't do worse.
I wouldn't mind maybe a driver being a robot, but when you get in the air, that's too far for me.
Yeah, but in the air is where less stuff can go wrong. A robot's a much better thing to drive. I mean, there's so much happens on the road.
See, I find
that's the worst place. You need a little bit of like cognizant thought or intuition.
Say something happens in the air, the robot is programmed for what the robot is programmed. Us humans, we work on gut feelings, intuition, stuff like that. A robot can never do that.
Yeah.
But so what gut feelings do you need when you're just flying in the air?
I watched a movie called Flight the other day. This dude turned the aircraft on its belly and flew it because the one wing was broken. I don't see a robot doing that.
Of course a robot could do that, because a robot is all about calculations and science and numbers and mathematics and probabilities and best outcome scenario. So it could do a quick calculation to override human error, or, you know, which sometimes gets blamed for a lot of accidents. It's human error.
Exactly.
With a robot, you wipe out that possibility, because it can just get straight to figuring out the equation.
I guess if technology gets to that point, I may trust it in the air.
Well, Michael, your point is you're trusted on the ground. If you ever need human interactions on the ground, you think a robot's going to work out that taxi over there will now be in your lane in 2 seconds' time? Of course not. It's an interesting thing. Anyway, Mubs, we had to cut your news short earlier because Justice was here, as always, sharing his insights. Anything else you want to bring up?
Well, you know, all around the world, different cultures and different nations observe or mark national holidays, right? We often talk about our public holidays here in South Africa, and you know how some of us feel that, there's just too many of them. And, you know, others say, no, the more the merrier. Anyway, April the 7th marks a national day in the United States. And if you are a connoisseur or a fan and can tell the difference between things such as ales and lagers and stouts and malts, today is National Beer Day in the United States. Mm. Now, you might be thinking, just another excuse to just get drunk. Actually, National Beer Day is an unofficial holiday in the United States, which is celebrated every year on April the 7th. And it marks the day back in 1933, which was the first day in 13 years that people could legally buy, sell, and drink beer. You'll, of course, remember the Prohibition era. That was a law which basically prevented manufacturers and sellers of alcohol from doing so. And that lasted from 1920 to 1933. I mean, we have never lived in a time where alcohol was illegal, right?
Thankfully not. We would have battled.
Can you imagine existing in a time where alcohol was illegal? Flex, you, I mean, all the weekends
where's
that you...
Where's the fun in that?
All the weekends you have woken up with hangovers, I mean, none of that would have been... I mean, it would have been a lot more difficult because it means that you would be getting those hangovers illegally, which means that you would risk prison time and all sorts of things.
Imagine trying to act sober because you're scared you'll be arrested because you drank beer. And now you got to explain, no, not beer.
So National Beer Day is a celebration of the Cullen-Harrison Act being signed into law. It was signed into law by President Franklin D. Roosevelt on March the 22nd back in 1993. Upon signing the legislation, Roosevelt made his famous remark, "I think this would be a good time for a beer." And hence National Beer Day was born.
You know what goes really good with beer?
And pussy too.
Thanks, Barack.
Yeah.
Full of information today, isn't he?
Yes, he is, definitely.
You know, National Beer Day is actually coming. Oh, it is Pooza Thursday. There we go. It's a nice excuse.
There you go.
But we don't make a big thing of it here. I mean, we should support our fellow countries.
Our fellow...
See, if there's a National Mojito Day, I'll be down with it. Beer can give me a boss mojito anytime.
You see, you can make your own, huh? There's National Days for anything. You just stick your flag in National Mojito Day.
Yeah. Let's actually see. Oh, July the 11th, National Mojito Day.
Oh, no. You could coin any kind of day you feel like for any day of the calendar. Just.
All right, cool. July 11th, we're doing this, right?
Yeah. Cool. December 31st, National Champagne Day. We can keep this going.
Well, that makes sense.
That's hardly a stretch.
Who decides on these days? Does someone just thumb suck it and make it go viral online?
Someone who wants more days off and more reasons to drink.
Well, it's just about people keeping up a practice once it started and then just making sure that that carries on. Some of these days are born out of complete myth, you know?
Yeah. Like No Pants Day. And then the rest of the world's not wearing pants.
There's a day?
There's a day called No Pants Day.
Yeah, well, that was just started by a pervert.
See, but the thing is, like when does the day become official? Is there any sort of organization that's basically rubber stamping these things?
For me, it's Apple, because when it says observed on my Apple calendar on my phone, that is when I know it's official. It gets,
but I mean, like, how many people must not wear pants for No Pants Day to become official?
Look, I think a lot of these days are born just out of marketing and advertising, you know, and that kind of thing. I mean, No Cleavage Day, for example.
Oh, no, not No Cleavage Day, Cleavage Day.
Sorry.
Is there a day where there's
cleavage
no cleavage?
Day, like show your cleavage.
That sounds like a horrible day.
There's no bra day?
Yes, that's what I was trying to say. No bra day, all right?
But so that's separate to Cleavage Day, though.
Yes, but what I'm saying is, I'm sure it was born out of some kind of marketing thing or PR thing.
It's Silly Hat Day.
Okay, well, if no one owns it, let's own it. Let's put it out together. Let's put a Cliff Central calendar out, and we'll keep you abreast of all these days.
Ah, okay.
So you never miss another official day in your entire life. And it's quite cool. If you like looking to get dressed and you go, oh, I need to do something different today. Oh, look at that. It's No Pants Day. Hey, presto.
I don't have to worry then.
You don't have to worry about pants. And then you get to work and no one's wearing pants.
Yeah.
Then we know we're living in a civilized society.
And then if you do wear pants on No Pants Day, then you must be shamed. I mean, really, you're going against everything that, you know, makes us who we are.
But the day speaks so highly of.
Sandy Sile says that we must stop jumping over Michael and listen to what he has to say and don't dismiss his ideas. Sorry, Michael, when did we do that?
I don't know. I think Sandy Sile also doesn't want robots taking over the world just like I don't.
Yeah. No, look, Sandy Sile, it's not like we have robust debates here. I think there's a fine line between robust debating and jumping all over. Look, I mean, we probably cross it, but...
We should celebrate Pajama Day. That's something that I'm actually want to push for in the office.
Wasn't there one of those things? I remember when I started here almost 2 years ago, there was Pajama Day. All of you guys were in pajamas, even Damon.
Remember that? No, that was... What?
Malaria. Wasn't it the
you guys were all in pajamas?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes, there was some kind of campaign happening, and these people came and brought through. They're not, I mean, I suppose you could wear them as pajamas, but they brought through these pants for us, and then we all wore them. Weren't we wearing them with our slippers as well?
Yeah.
Because there's a National Slipper Day in this country.
Yeah, exactly.
In school, we used to do Pajama Day and Silly Hat Day. Everyone would rock up in pajamas. It was nice because you didn't have to get dressed in the morning. You'd just go straight from bed.
I don't think Sia would have enjoyed that day much, huh?
Guys, who... Oh, no.
Yeah, look, as Kala says, the Bride Day is a brilliant example of marketing. And yes, Kala, I did see Mr. Players hurl in one. I mentioned it at the start of the show. It's one of those things that sometimes the day then gets hijacked because it's actually Heritage Day. But no one knows that it's Heritage Day if you all know it's Bride Day.
Yeah.
Which is also kind of defeats the object, really.
Yes.
You don't want to discredit a holiday. You want to create something new. Anyway, we're running out of time. We actually need to wrap this up. But if you've got any suggestions of days and you think that we should observe them, again, email mike@cliffcentral.com along with any song requests. Tomorrow is your last day to get a song request because Gareth will be back on Monday and he'll be back to normal. So while the cat is still away, let us mouse as mice play. Mubs, anything you want to wrap up with?
No, just that Loyiso Bala is coming up next.
Yes, he's poised and ready.
Yes. Welcome back, Loyiso, from your holiday. So that's the open book coming up next.
Yep, Michael.
Just take your vitamin C with the change in weather. You're bound to get flu. So as you wake up, take vitamin C, go to work.
Very good. And lastly from Sia, who had his vitamin C this morning when he came in at 6:15.
Yes.
Okay, very good. Sia, best contribution of the day. We'll be back tomorrow, normal time. It is Friday tomorrow. Yay. And Gareth will be on the lines, hopefully a better connection, and we'll catch you then. CliffCentral.com.